From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the one affliction most people feel okay shaming or bullying people about. It's obesity. Nearly 80% of adults, 30% of children, meet the clinical definition of being overweight or obese. The journalist Michael Hobbs has written a remarkable piece for the Huffington Post where he examines the stigma and the emotional costs of obesity. He'll join us after this.
Hello, podcast listener. This is Elaine Clark. I'm one of the producers for Radio West. You'll notice today's show's a little bit shorter than usual. It's because it's KUER's Fall Fun Drive, so you're missing out on several minutes of appeal to support the station, Radio West, and the podcast you're listening to. But you're savvy. You know how it works. KUER relies on your support to make this all possible. If you're already a sustainer, thank you. If not, you can join for as little as $5 a month. Just go to our website, radiowest.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Michael Hobbs says years from now, we are all going to look back on the ways we addressed the obesity epidemic and the way we treated people who are obese, and we're going to feel ashamed of ourselves because we have been barbaric to people who struggle with their weight. We tell them this is a personal failing, that they're weak-willed, and we know larger Americans earn less in wages and are less likely to be promoted or hired in the first place. And Hobbs says the medical system, healthcare professionals, doctors, have ideas about obesity that are cartoonishly out of step with a generation of research into obesity and human behavior. Hobbs spent more than a year writing and researching a piece for Huffington Post's long-form publication, Highline. It's called Everything You Know About Obesity Is Wrong. And he joined us recently to talk about it. The thing that got him thinking about all of this was his mom. Growing up, Hobbs says, his mom's weight was the uncredited co-star of every family drama.
I have had a chip on my shoulder about this issue for 3 decades, and a lot of that comes from the fact that growing up, my mom was dieting her entire life and my entire life. She was always struggling with her weight. She would lose 60 pounds and then gain 80 and then lose 50 and gain 100 and then gain lose 150 and gain 2. Like, always yo-yoing, always feeling really bad about herself. And I mean, never not trying, right? She would swim 5-6 days a week. She biked almost everywhere she went. She was always doing some new exercise thing, some new insane diet, and it was never enough. And I just saw the way that the world treated her and the nasty comments we would get in restaurants and the way that there was this kind of eye rolling or anything whenever she mentioned anything about food or anything about exercise, just this kind of pervasive discrediting of her. And even as a small child, it just seemed unfair to me that this person is trying really hard and no matter what they're doing, everyone is telling them that they should be trying harder. Mm.
So interesting that it wasn't until last year that you actually sat down and talked to her about all of this.
So I interviewed 66 people for this article. Yeah. And so many of them said that they don't talk to anybody about this. One of the guys, Sam, that I interviewed in my article, which isn't his real name, none of the men that I interviewed for this article would allow me to use their real names. Wow. And he said his wife doesn't know. His wife doesn't know how much he thinks about his weight. She doesn't know that he has these binge eating things after he catches a glimpse of himself in a security camera or a reflection in a store window. He can't even speak about this to his own wife. And I heard this so often that it's something that people think about a lot, but they don't allow themselves to tell people what they're really feeling about it. And that just seems really, really sick to me in a way, that it's something that we're all so preoccupied with. I mean, people, even if you're not fat, so many people are terrified of becoming fat. And that underlies so much of our conversation about food and our conversation about exercise. And yet, it's very rare that we hear from actual fat people about what their experience is like and talk about, you know, the broader social and cultural impact of, you know, people always worry that, oh, are we glorifying obesity? Are we glorifying obesity? But we never worry about the way that we're glorifying conventional attractiveness and the ways that that affects us. And so, you know, the minute you start talking to people about it, there's just this huge well of hurt and anger and fear and anxiety and it's so hard to talk about. So many of my interviews, I would interview them about this. And then the next day they'd say, are you sure you're not going to use my name? And then the next day they'd say, are you sure you're really not going to use my name? People are not comfortable being on the record about this stuff.
And your mom saying that that the way it affected her life, that it kept her from doing the things she always wanted to do, because she figured, as she said to you, people who are fat can't or shouldn't be doing these things. So it drastically affected her life.
And this is something I never knew about her. You know, I knew that she got her PhD really late. I knew that she got her master's degree really late. But I had no sense of the ways that she kept herself from putting herself up for jobs or, you know, asking a boss for promotion because she thought, you know, fat people can't do this, or fat people aren't supposed to want to do this, or I have to wait until I look the right way until I get this corporate job. And what's really interesting actually about sort of the data and academic work on weight-based bullying is that we sort of think of the way that fat shaming works as like someone shouting at you across the street or someone shaming you in a restaurant. And these things do happen and they're very pervasive. Yeah. But a lot of the people I talked to said, no one has ever bullied me. No one has ever mentioned anything about my weight. It just, I bullied myself because I thought, I'll go on a dating website once I lose 60 pounds, or I'll start applying for jobs once I lose 50 pounds. That people, there's this self-talk about weight that is really pernicious and really sort of self-discrediting in a way that is, again, underneath the surface, but it's really rare that people discuss this kind of stuff.
And it's isolating. This is another one of the things you explore in the piece. And this was interesting. You mentioned that as a gay man yourself, even though it was difficult, you at least had this opportunity to come out of a closet and declare your identity. But you say obese people, they don't get a moment like that.
And what was so interesting is I was interviewing one of these weight stigma researchers, and it turned out that he was gay as well. And we sort of had this kind of like connection, oh, we're both gay. And then I was like, all right, dude, you know, brass tacks, you're gay, I'm gay. We both came out, like everyone in America got a gay cousin in like 1996. Yeah. And now social attitudes are so much better for gay people than they were. But everybody, I mean, there's way more fat people in the country than there are gay people, right? And so why hasn't this same thing? Attitudes toward fat people are worse now than they were in the 1990s, which doesn't work for any other minority group. And what he said was, coming out isn't about exposure. Coming out isn't about showing yourself to the rest of the world. Coming out is about telling people that you're not going to apologize for who you are. It's really about yourself, right? That even if you come out to your aunt and uncle and they're really homophobic and they keep that homophobia, you never change their attitude. You feel like you stood up to a bully. You did it. You get the self-esteem boost and you stop apologizing and you can live your life openly. A lot of fat people don't get that. There isn't sort of a cultural narrative around, you know what, I'm not trying to lose weight. I mean, I heard from so many of the people that I interviewed that there's this idea of like the good fatty, that when you're in public, you have to be eating salads. And whenever any time weight or food or exercise comes up, you always have to make these subtle acknowledgments that I'm trying to become smaller, I'm trying to become thinner. That's the pressure on you all the time. And it's so rare for a fat person to just say, nope, I'm happy as I am. And, you know, I eat when I'm hungry. And sometimes I go exercising when I want to. And sometimes I don't. And that's fine. I mean, it's very rare that you get that. And so for a lot of people, they said that there sort of isn't a model for coming out. I mean, nobody really knows what coming out as a fat person really means, because you already feel so exposed in the world, and there isn't a way or a sort of script to use to just say, I'm actually fine like this, and please don't bring up my weight anymore.
Yeah. We'll come back around to that as the article does. But I wanna get this out of the way. What are the terms we use or should use? I have to say, I feel weird about saying fat.
Ah, so do I, man. It's so weird. I know. It's, as a non-fat person, I felt really uncomfortable using the word for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have this sort of euphemistic way of talking about weight, you know, where we say like you're plump or you're curvy or full figured, or, you know, these things that are in some way infantilizing, or in some way you're trying not to be stigmatizing, but it ends up kind of being stigmatizing because everyone can see the way that you're talking around it. And so in the same way that queer people have reclaimed the word queer, starting in the 1970s, fat activists were saying, we are fat.
Yeah.
Like, don't talk around this. One of the women that I interviewed, Emily, she said, you know, she'll be talking about da-da-da as a fat person, da-da-da, and her friends will interrupt her and say, oh, sweetie, you're not fat. You look great. You're big and beautiful. And she's like, I'm a size 28. I am a fat person. This is the way that I like to be called. This is me reclaiming this. This is a neutral descriptor of how I move through the world. And yeah. So she says it's always kind of patronizing when people stop her and say, oh, you're not fat. When like she says, no, I am fat. And that's fine. This is how I choose to identify myself. Mm. But it's also an interesting thing in that lots and lots of larger people are not comfortable with this word. My mom, who has struggled with her weight her whole life, refers to herself as overweight.
Yeah.
And she gets hit. It really hurts her feelings when anybody calls her fat. And it hurts. She's not ready to call herself fat yet because she still on some level thinks that her size is temporary. And so many people do. And so that's another thing that is really unique about fat people as a minority group is that there aren't very many other minority groups in America that you go in and out of, right? You don't become gay and then become not gay and then become gay again, or, you know, become a Mormon and then switch back and then become a Mormon. Like, that doesn't happen. Whereas with fat people, you sort of are switching back and forth and taking this identity or not, or in a room with a lot of people that are larger than you, you're kind of not the fat person in the room, but then in other places you are. And it's one of those things that makes it really difficult to form that identity because there's still this idea that it's temporary, and also makes it really hard to talk about that. Mm. Like, I would never refer to somebody as fat unless I heard them refer to themselves with that term first.
Yeah.
Right. But talking about the group as a whole, the preferred terminology is fat. But I mean, I still feel weird talking about it in these terms, and I'm still kind of getting used to actually saying that word out loud.
Yeah. We're going to put a link to your article on our website because the photographs, I think, are a really important part of it. You ask the interview subjects to take full creative control of their photos. So just explain this part of it because they're really lovely. They're terrific.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you come across in the literature and that fat people have been screaming about for decades is that whenever there's a story about obesity, and you still see this today, what's the picture that they use to illustrate any story about obesity? The headless fat people. And it's always headless in, like, even for a headless photo, it's not flattering, right?
Yeah.
It's somebody who's wearing clothes that are tight. It's usually somebody with, like, a bag of food, right? It's oftentimes somebody sort of walking around downtown. They're poorly dressed. They're only shopping the neck down, and they're carrying McDonald's, right? Or they're eating a burrito. And it's,
yeah.
I mean, fat people have been saying for decades, like, we are people. You can actually illustrate a story about obesity with just a larger person sitting at a desk, and they are an accountant, and they're working on an Excel spreadsheet. Like, fat people have jobs too. Like, fat people walk their dogs. Fat people raise their kids. Like, you walk out in the world, and you see fat people of all kinds of shapes and sizes and colors and professions and whatever. And then you open a magazine and there's skinny people and there's headless torsos. Those are the only depictions. And so it actually happened a couple times that I would reach out to people to interview them for this story and say, hey, I'm working on a story about obesity. Can I talk to you? And they'd be like, as long as you don't use the headless photos. Like, that's the condition of talking to me. And I mean, this is something that is so normalized. And yet to fat people, every single time they see that, they're like, I am actually more than just my body carrying a bag of McDonald's. Mm. So, you know, from day one, from working on this article, I worked on it for maybe 15 or 18 months or something like that.
Wow.
Day one, the conversation with the editors was always, we need to illustrate this with none of like the tropes that you usually see. Another thing you often see is like, it'll say obesity and they use graphic design to have like the letters bulging, right? And there's like a belt around the letters
right.
The letters are like pushing out the belt like, oh, we're all getting fatter. And again, it's always framed in this sort of disease, bad kind of way. And so we came up with this idea about halfway through that we should just ask people, like, what do you wish you saw of fat people when you were a kid? I mean, a lot of the people that I interviewed for the story have been fat since they were 3 or 5 or 6 years old. And they've never seen, one of them said, I've never seen a romantic lead that looks like me, mm-hmm. right? There's always like the fat friend or like the sassy fat friend, but there's never like a normal fat woman who like does a normal job falling in love with a boy. Like, I've never seen that in my whole life. And so we just wanted to kind of be the depictions that people wished they had seen when they were kids. And they all came up with great ideas. And so, and I think you can see it in the faces of the subjects that we photographed too. I mean, all the people that I interviewed are just like the coolest people. And all of them look really proud and look really happy in their photos. And I think some of that probably comes from the fact that we were there and saying, okay, do whatever you want to do. Like, send us a paragraph of how you want to be depicted in the world. And it's your words and it's your images and it's going to be your posing and you choosing where we do it. And I think that really comes through. And it's, I mean, it's a pretty low bar for this of just how do you want to be photographed? But it fat people just never get that kind of basic level of courtesy.
There's this example you use right up front in the article, scurvy. And how scurvy killed millions. I had no idea. It killed like 2 million sailors over the course of some 300 years. And that for much of those years, as you point out, most of those years, that medical experts knew what to do about scurvy. And this is kind of the point. You describe this as a kind of myopia that repeats itself over and over and over. Now, explain, what's going on?
Well, I mean, what's really interesting is if you start looking at the research, you find articles from, you know, I found one from 1991 that's making every single article that I make in my piece in 2018, every single article was being published in academic journals in 1991, every single one.
Yeah.
And for years, people have pointed out, okay, diets don't work. We know that 95 to 98% of diets do not work. It's because any crash diet, you're going to lose a ton of weight. You're going to feel really good about yourself. You're going to think this, you know, new life is on the horizon for you. And then the minute you stop, you know, drinking the liquid meals or you can't handle the zero carbs lifestyle anymore as a normal person would, you start gaining the weight back because your body is adjusting to the normal diet that you're giving it. And so you gain all the weight back, and oftentimes in 66% of the time, you gain back more than you lost. And so we talk a lot about the health impacts of obesity and how heart disease and blah, blah, blah. But we don't really talk about the health impacts of dieting all the time and health impacts of being told, no matter what, that losing weight is an imperative when we know that losing weight is impossible. We don't give people medications that fail 95 to 98% of the time and make them worse 2/3 of the time. We don't, like, we would never accept that in a medication. And yet, dieting, that's the prescription that we've been giving people, right? And we also know that shaming people for their weight, of being mean about it or not listening to them when they say, hey, I'm already eating lots of fruits and vegetables and exercising, not believing them, discrediting them, is also extremely bad for them. We know that social shaming, especially from experts like doctors, is really bad for your stress system. It's really bad for your mental health. It's bad for your physical health. And yet, we're still encouraging this behavior that is completely unsustainable and in the long run makes people worse. And so it's very weird that when you talk to public health people and doctors and things, they're just like, oh yeah, we should keep doing what we're doing.
Which is like a fad dieter. It's the same thing they do.
That's the thing. It's like, well, let's do the same thing again.
Yeah, right.
But like, let's do the same thing again harder. And like, you know, one thing that I heard from fat people was, no matter what happens, you're the problem, right? It's never like, hey, you know, we put you on an unrealistic diet. We're really sorry. It's, why can't you stick to this diet?
Yeah.
Why can't you live on 800 calories a day? You know, this one woman told me she couldn't write emails at work. She was like almost fainting at work because she was eating so few calories. She would start a sentence in an email and forget what she was writing halfway through the sentence. And, you know, she goes back to the doctor and says, look, this is insane. This is really isn't working for me. And they're like, well, you just need to persevere. You need to carry on. Or, oh, you don't have, you know, high adherence. You're not adhering to the diet. And so she becomes the problem when we've known for decades that this doesn't work for almost anybody. I mean, unless you have the iron will of like Madonna or something to just like not eat your entire life and just be hungry 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's just not a realistic prescription for anybody, and yet the prescription hasn't changed. One of the quotes that I didn't get to use in the article was a doctor told me the medical treatment of obesity has not meaningfully changed since the 1960s. It's eat less. Here's a 500 calorie a day diet. That's it. We haven't done anything differently.
Yeah. You also mentioned how being large, being fat, doesn't necessarily mean that you're sick or unhealthy. And here's how you put it in the article. Individuals are not averages. I think that seems like an important point.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a gay man, I have a good perspective on this, in that, I mean, my lifespan statistically is 4 years shorter than yours, right? Like, statistically, I'm about 8 times more likely to be using illegal drugs. And yet, when I go to the doctor for an earache, they don't say, oh, it's probably the meth. You know, oh, it's, I'm sure you're taking meth. No, they ask me, what is your lifestyle? Maybe they'll ask me, hey, what are your sexual practices, right? Because I'm in a high-risk group.
Yeah.
But they're not, they don't just assume that I'm taking meth. They don't assume that I'm going to die. And yet this weird, we get with every other group that there's a huge, everything is an overlapping circle, right? That some people take meth, or some gay people take meth, and some people don't. But for fat people, it's like, oh, well, there's these averages that fat people have higher rates of cardiovascular disease. Therefore, every individual fat person must be unhealthy. And it's not, I mean, that's not the case. There's something called metabolically healthy obesity that is these up to, it's between 30% and 75% of fat people have totally normal metabolisms. Their resting heart rate is fine and their LDL cholesterol is fine, blah, blah, blah. And there's a huge percentage of skinny people who are metabolically unhealthy, right? Who are pre-diabetic and who have high resting heart rates and who never exercise. We all have this friend, right? And so these individual variations, it's like we pretend that they don't exist. We pretend that it's black and white. As soon as we're presented with an individual, which is just, we don't apply this to any other statistical sample.
Michael Hobbs, he's a senior enterprise reporter for the Huffington Post. His article is called Everything You Know About Obesity is Wrong. It appeared on the online HuffPost publication Highline. We have a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the one affliction most people feel okay shaming or bullying people about. It's obesity. The journalist Michael Hobbs has written an article for the Huffington Post where he examines the stigma and the emotional costs of obesity. It's called Everything You Know About Obesity is Wrong.
Let's talk about doctors. Doctors, you say in the piece, they're supposed to be trusted authorities, but for fat people, really they're a source of just, as you say, persistent trauma. And I like how you actually measure this. You say it's not just an anecdotal impression that doctors treat fat patients differently. They have shorter appointments with fat patients. They show measurably less emotional rapport. Talk a little bit about this, because this is a huge issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's a study that I cited in there where they showed doctors a bunch of charts of patients, and they said, all right, this patient is suffering from migraines, and there's stuff in their chart about their race and their income and blah, blah, blah. And migraines. This has nothing to do with weight. Migraines. And patients who are listed as fat, the doctors say, oh, she probably won't take my advice. This probably isn't the right diagnosis. She's probably got a bad attitude, right? And this has nothing to do with her weight. This is just pure stigma. And what's amazing is one of my sources, this actually happened to her, that when she was 17, she had migraines and her neurologist kept telling her, well, you need to lose weight. And she said to him, I'm like 6 feet tall and like 155 pounds. I actually don't need to lose weight. And he told her, oh, you need to lose weight if you want to have a baby. And she's 17.
Wow.
And it's like, I mean, I could not believe the depths and the extremities of what fat people experience at the doctor, that it's so difficult to get a doctor to diagnose you with anything other than a weight problem. Another one of the women that I interviewed went in with stomach pains, and she's African-American, and her doctor told her, maybe if you ate less fried chicken, you wouldn't have a problem. Her mother, who's with her, says this is unacceptable, finally gets them to run some tests. Turned out she has an inflamed bile duct. She spends 3 days in the hospital recovering. And this happens over, it's like every, I remember interviewing people about this and they tell me a story and I'd be like, okay, that's terrible. You know, let's move on. And they're like, that's the first time a doctor did this to me. I have six other stories like this. And throughout people's lives, I mean, they go in for allergies and they tell you, oh, have you tried like switching from soda to diet soda? You know, and it's like, well, what do you tell thin people that come in with this? And then all of a sudden the doctor has all these ideas. And so one of the things it's a difficult thing to study, right? Of how much are fat people being misdiagnosed? Yeah. And how many times are they being sent home with real medical problems? One woman who got in touch after the article was published, her doctor told her to lose weight for years. And she finally talked them into doing an MRI. And she had a 12-pound tumor inside of her. And they removed it. And the radiologist said it was the biggest tumor he'd ever seen. And it's impossible. Like, we don't have data on how many people are sent home with health problems because it's so difficult to measure. But, I mean, you talk to fat people and, like, this is a huge problem in medicine of people just are not being listened to.
Well, it's interesting, too. You write about how most doctors are kind of a type. I mean, they're fit. They're overachievers. They've had to work through the stress of medical school. So in some ways, they can't really relate. They're not very good at empathizing with people who are struggling with weight.
Yeah. I think about this all the time because my doctor, who's like extremely hot, extremely straight, went to Yale, jogs, like the hospital's near my house, he jogs through my neighborhood with his shirt off.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'm like, hey, doc, and he's got this like gleaming six pack. And it's just like, I don't want this guy seeing fat patients. Like he doesn't, you know, I mean, in the same way, doctors, like we like to think of them as these kind of exalted heroes, but I think that they suffer from the same biases as the rest of us. And one thing that I think is really difficult for individuals and for doctors to see is that what works for you doesn't work for other people, right? That I can see like a hot 2% body fat doctor type saying, well, why don't you go jogging 3 times a week and then you'll have a six pack. And oftentimes fat people, they already are jogging 3 times a week, right? I mean, I interviewed somebody who was a competitive swimmer in high school. I mean, doing way more exercise than I ever did in high school. And she's just still big. She's always been big. And whenever she goes into the doctor, they're like, oh, well, have you tried taking the stairs instead of the elevator? And she's like, I was up at 5 this morning in the swimming pool, punk. Like, I don't need your like off-brand advice about this.
Yeah,
and I think one of the things that makes it really difficult to deal with this stuff is that doctors sort of, and I think people just refuse to see that what works for you is based on the individual vicissitudes of your weird body. And other people's bodies don't respond to like a low carb diet or a vegan diet or whatever works for you. Other people's bodies don't respond the same way. And it's not fair to obligate other people to do things that they may already be doing, or they have other reasons for why those things will not work for them.
You write about the structural problems too. Like doctors can get thousands of dollars for ordering, you know, a course of blood tests and then like $25 for a session of diet and nutritional counseling. And then there's the other problem you mentioned in the piece of the just medical education system that keeps doctors from properly dealing with people who have obesity. They don't get much training about, what is it, 19 hours of training over
in
the course
years.
Of their medical school?
Yeah, and that's less than it was in 2006.
Yeah.
Some researchers studied it twice. And so, I mean, it's also, I mean, how bananas is that, right? That it's like we know what's going on in the country. We know the epidemics of diet-related diseases that we have, and we're teaching less nutrition education to doctors. Another thing, I interviewed a guy who teaches doctors soft skills. Like, that's his job, is to teach them, like, more empathy and active listening skills. And he says a lot of them are also not getting skills in just listening and asking patients things before assuming things about them. So he says oftentimes you'll have like my doctor, a white, wealthy, trim doctor who says to a low-income mother of 5, you know, I really know what it's like to not have time to cook. And like, you don't. That's not an empathy-building skill, right? That's actually what he's doing, is he's creating a distance between himself and her because he doesn't know how to frame these issues other than referring to himself, right? And these are basic skills that this is what this guy teaches, is how to build rapport and how to ask things in a way that doesn't assume that you already know. Like, hey, what diets have you tried before? Or do you mind if we talk about your diet and exercise today? These are things that you can do. Like, these are specific skills. But doctors are mostly being taught biology in school for understandable reasons. Mm-hmm. But what we're learning in field after field after field is that these soft skills are really meaningful as far as getting people to stick with an adherence regime, getting people to feel heard by their doctors, getting people to focus on preventative care. You can't have a doctor that feels stigmatizing to you. You know, like when I go into the doctor, if my doctor's like, oh, you must be using condoms, right? I'll bet you're not using condoms. That's like a really like mean thing to say. And it just doesn't build a rapport between us. But they can be trained in things like, hey, do you mind if I ask you about your safe sexual practices today? And most doctors know this on safe sex stuff and on substance abuse stuff, but they refuse to learn it on food stuff.
It's interesting. You one of the great parts about the article, I thought, for me was you kind of explain how fat shaming works, that, you know, this how the stigma works. And there's this biological component to it where it seems like we're kind of programmed to be mean to fat people. There was this researcher at UCLA I wanted you to talk about who talked about how we are attuned to bodies that look different. Like, it's baked into our genes.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most depressing things about this is how pervasive fat stigma is and also how resilient, you know, that you can do these trainings with people where you're like, oh, you know, obesity is super biological and lots of fat people have the same diet and exercise habits as you do. And then like a week later, you survey those same people and they're like, oh yeah, fat people are lazy.
Yeah.
Like these attitudes don't respond to information. And I do think a lot of that comes back to how so many of us are afraid of becoming fat. I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to that because if you think fat people are fine, then you might have to accept that it's okay for you to be a fat person. And that's very scary for a lot of people. Mm. And I think, I mean, one of these things that, you know, it's so obvious when you say it, and yet in daily practice is not obvious, is that shaming people is extremely bad for their health. That it activates this entire cortisol and adrenaline response system where you're sort of tensed after one of these negative interactions. And so a lot of fat people say that after they are fat shamed, it makes them want to eat. They want to comfort eat, right? Like, what makes you want to comfort eat more than feeling rejected by people you want to fit in with, right? And it actually makes your body hold on to fat more. So there's this whole cortisol response system where you get stressed, your cortisol system blasts you with all these stress hormones, and those stress hormones actually make you hungrier, give you less energy, and make you absorb more calories. So by shaming fat people, you're actually causing the health problems you're pretending to solve, right? If you're really concerned, and this is what the research, this researcher Janet Tomiyama, this is what she told me, that if you're really concerned for somebody's health, you'd just be nice to them. I mean, being nice to people is great for their health. This is not a radical thing. And yet the minute you try to suggest this, people just go bananas.
You write that since 1980, the obesity rate has increased in 113 countries, and it's doubled in 73 countries. And since 1980, not one of those countries has managed to reduce its obesity rate.
Yes.
Like, what do you make of that?
I mean, this is the thing, is that this is why anything that involves personal responsibility or willpower just makes no sense. And one of the things that didn't end up in the article that I'm totally obsessed with is that if you think about, okay, what changed between 1970 and 1990? Not super much, right? Mm. Whereas what changed between 1880 and 1980, right? That we have this entire period of all of American history where people are leaving farms, people are moving to cities, people are getting office jobs, people are doing way less physical work. And yet, obesity rates didn't budge. So when we talk about things like, oh, Americans don't get exercise anymore, all of that happened 30 years before the obesity epidemic.
Right.
So it really isn't about that we're all driving everywhere necessarily, or that we all decided to do less farm work. A lot of it has to do with our food supply. That when you look into the research on globalization, what happens in 1980 is international trade for agricultural commodities becomes much easier. And so it becomes far more profitable to process foods. This is when, you know, Lucky Charms comes onto the market, and Eggos and Twinkies and Oreos and all of these things that seem kind of benign, but they're basically just various combinations of sugar and flour and oil and, you know, and a little bit of flavoring. And these foods are uniquely bad for us. Where public health really needs to go is making it easier for us to eat good foods regardless of our size, and just making, like, school lunches are like the super obvious one, but then also, you know, what we subsidize and things like that. And when you look at the way that the food industry and what's available to us has changed, that's really the only thing that explains worldwide. Like, why are there more obese people in China now than there were 40 years ago. It's not that they're all lazy, right? It's not that they're like, or that they don't know that they're supposed to be eating fruits and vegetables, but they did know that 40 years ago. I mean, none of these individual explanations make sense. The only thing that makes any sense is that the global food system has rewarded value-added foods and has propped up companies like, you know, Coca-Cola and Nestle and Unilever and all these big companies that are producing so much of our food now, and that's what the whole world is eating now.
Just 4% of agricultural subsidies go for fruits and vegetables. And there's a statistic you mentioned which is really striking. The U.S. spends $60 billion a year on drug research and just $1.5 billion on nutrition. So, like, the incentives and our focus is really out of proportion. It's really screwed up, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's much better for the medical system and for GDP for you to become unhealthy and then we give you statins for cholesterol that you take every day. That's great for GDP. You actually, you know, being able to afford healthy food and living in a neighborhood that allows you to go play in a park with your kids twice a week, yeah, that's actually bad for GDP. This sounds like some conspiracy theory stuff, but I don't think anybody like deliberately created the system, but these are the incentives that the system has within it, right? That care is much more lucrative than prevention. We don't invest very much in things like, you know, how many kids walk and bike to school these days? Yep. I mean, that would be a really obvious way for kids to get 30, 45 minutes of exercise a day. And it's 13% of kids, right? They're all driving to school. And we know that that is really good for kids to move around more. But it's not going to affect their weights all that much, probably, if they're already large, which is fine. But we just haven't really tried these kinds of obvious things of being like, hey, let's feed kids good food and get them moving more. All of our emphasis is always on let's reduce obesity rates. Let's reduce obesity rates. And again, 95 to 98% of obesity interventions fail for the same reasons that individual diets fail, that you can't really get kids or anybody else to lose weight and keep it off. What you can do is make them way healthier. There's all these interventions that are like, let's get fat kids to play soccer. And the fat kids play soccer and all of their health markers improve. They have better self-esteem. They have better diabetes. They have better blood pressure. They're healthier in every single way, but their weights don't fall. Yeah. And so the researchers conclude, they're like, oh, it's a failed intervention. Oh, we tried getting kids to play soccer, but unfortunately, they didn't lose any weight. Well, that's actually a great thing for kids of all sizes, no matter what. It's great for kids to be playing soccer a couple times a week, but we're abandoning these things because they're not affecting weights when we just need to shift what we think of as the goal of public health.
Well, talk about that, because that's one of the things you say. You say we need a new paradigm. We need a paradigm shift. What does that look like exactly as you're envisioning it?
I mean, this is going to sound radical to people, but my preferred policy method is to give up on weight as the goal of public health. That we know that it's very difficult to get individuals or populations. So what we need to do is completely abandon weight as the goal of any of these interventions, and health is much more malleable than weight. You can improve somebody's blood pressure and cholesterol numbers in like 2 weeks of just like eating more fruits and vegetables and like maybe walking to the bus stop, right? Mm-hmm. And so we know what to do to improve health, but we refuse to see it because we're like, oh, they're still fat. Oh, they're still fat. They need to lose weight. But what if we just didn't care? And like, let's just try to feed kids good food and get everyone, you know, adults too, moving more, eating more, and things like, how many fruits and vegetables did you eat this week? That's a great indicator of your health and the quality of your diet. That should be the thing that we go for. And maybe you get fatter and maybe you get skinnier. I really don't care. To the extent that we care about weight at all, it should be to reduce fat shaming. It should be to have doctors listen to their fat patients and give them tests. I mean, we need to have a push on the negative impacts of fat shaming and reduce those. And then everyone else just needs to give up on weight. And weight is not malleable. Mm. Health is very malleable. And so we should focus on the malleable stuff.
Let me ask you this finally. There's one woman that you talked to who mentioned that her patients either live in the past or live in the future when it comes to their weight. And she says, what she tells them, and I like this, is just do the best with the body you have right now. Like, live in the present. You mentioned, like, you say, in a world that refuses to change, it's still up to every fat person alone to decide how to endure. Would you say something about that finally?
Well, I mean, there's all these, you know, policy prescriptions. And again, we've known the correct policies to take on for decades, and we haven't done them yet. And so it felt unfair at the end of this article to say, like, well, all this policy change is coming, so get ready. When, I mean, we know what the U.S. is like now, and it's getting harder to do these policies than it's ever been. And so in the face of a world that is not going to change for you, what can you do? And one of the things I really remember from my conversation with my mom about this was that when she was in her 20s, she always thought that she was sort of 20 pounds overweight, or 20 pounds over what the world wanted her to look like. And no one ever told her, it's actually okay. Yeah. Like, you're doing your best, you're living a good life, you've got good habits, your kids are fine. Like, you have a good life. It's actually fine to be 20 pounds overweight. And then because she kept trying to lose this last 20 pounds, she yo-yoed, right? She loses 40, she gains 30, she loses 50, blah, blah, blah. But she was never given the message that just focus on your habits and be the happiest person that you can be. And that is a message. I mean, so many people that I interviewed, they said, I had already had an eating disorder for 4 years by the time somebody told me, hey, being, you know, in this BMI category is actually fine. You're not obligated to have perfect habits. You're not obligated to look like a model. Just do the best you can. And it's actually, you know, public health and doctors are very resistant to this message, but you can actually just live the life that you want to be living. And maybe your weight will change and maybe it won't, but you can just, like my mom, you can just go to get your master's degree. You can get the promotion. You can do all this kind of stuff and just do your best.
Michael Hobbs, his article, Everything You Know About Obesity Is Wrong, appeared on the online Huffington Post publication Highline. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. He joined us from his office in Seattle. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Holly Vasek, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.